From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. It's back to work after the holiday weekend, and there is plenty to talk about. Is the summit with North Korea back on? What are lawmakers hearing back in their districts now that they're on recess? There's a new flashpoint in the Russia investigation. Rudy Giuliani running off again, this time saying Spygate is a PR ploy. Gas prices soar, missing immigrant children, and it's only Tuesday. This hour on Point, the week ahead in Washington and around the world. You can join us on air or online. Do you want the Singapore summit to happen? What do you make of Rudy Giuliani's comments about Spygate? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from Washington is Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Shauna, welcome back to On Point. Always great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a regular Fox News contributor. Byron, great to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And with us from Washington as well, Michael Crowley, National Security Editor and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Great to have you, Michael.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Well, a lot to discuss this hour, but I want to start with President Trump's Memorial Day activities. The president visited Arlington National Cemetery yesterday, where he laid a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier and delivered somber remarks to mark Memorial Day.
We cannot imagine the depth of emotion that this day brings. Each year, the grief renewed, the memories relived, those last beautiful moments together cherished and always remembered.
A tweet earlier in the day from the president had a somewhat different tone, however. He writes, quote, "Happy Memorial Day. Those who died for our great country would be happy and proud at how well our country is doing today. Best economy in decades, lowest unemployment numbers for blacks and Hispanics ever, and women in 18 years, rebuilding our military and so much more. Nice!" Exclamation point. Byron York, U.S. president typically leads the nation in shared rituals. Your reaction to the president's words?
Well, he didn't say Mueller was a witch hunt.
That was later.
Look, first of all, I think you did the right thing by playing a bit of Trump's speech, which was perfectly fine, the kind of thing one expects a president to do on Memorial Day. As far as the tweet is concerned, Trump doesn't communicate like other people, other presidents communicate. A number of people were absolutely appalled by it. It seemed completely off message. The tone was all wrong. My guess is the people who like Trump had no trouble with it. They didn't find it a bad message. But this is just example number 5,678 that Trump's tweets often have a tone that just drives many people crazy.
Michael Crowley, David Frum, the former Bush speechwriter, senior editor at The Atlantic now, called the president's tweet, quote, "the grossest, most inappropriate, self-flattering Memorial Day message in the history of the U.S. presidency." Your reaction?
My reaction is that we are now, I guess, about 16 months, maybe 17, into Donald Trump's presidency, and it still just doesn't feel normal. And, you know, some portion of the country loves that. But for a lot of people, people are just not getting used to it. And, every iteration of his performance of official presidential duties feels, you know, surreal, wildly out of the ordinary. And the simplest thing, like a Memorial Day proclamation, becomes yet another example of a country that is, you know, in some level at war with itself, at least politically, emotionally and psychologically. And it's, I think Byron did a nice job of critiquing the substance of the tweet. I would just say it's a sad thing in general that America is at a state like this where we can't have a president issue a Memorial Day message without a kind of a freak out. And it's a little remarkable to me that we're this far into the Trump presidency and it still all feels so incredibly raw. It's just not healthy for the country, whether or not you're a Trump supporter.
And I think that that in some ways the freak out is in this bubble that is Washington, D.C. to a certain extent. I think we also have to remember that the reach of Twitter feels very big in D.C. because so many of the journalists, even the ones in this room I'm sharing the studio with, I follow, they follow me, that whole thing. And so it all bubbles up. But for the most part, a lot of his tweets, other than once they get on television, don't reach a lot of the country. And in some ways, I'm not sure if he's crazy as a fox or what the situation is, but in some ways, it feels designed to make the Washington media freak out. And I think it is worth pointing out that the speech that was broadcast on national television yesterday hit a lot of the right notes, mm-hmm. even if some people don't like the person who is saying them. So maybe we just have to calm down a little.
Let's get to North Korea now. A flurry of activity going on as we speak to resurrect the summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. In brief remarks to reporters on Saturday, President Trump said lower-level negotiations regarding the summit were going well and that the summit he canceled last week could still happen.
A lot of people are working on it. It's moving along very nicely. So we're looking at June 12th in Singapore. That hasn't changed. And it's moving along pretty well. So we'll see what happens.
Michael Crowley, U.S. diplomats made a rare visit to North Korea over the weekend. Tell us where this stands. Does this mean this is back on?
Well, it's what an incredible story. What a case of whiplash we all have. The drama on Thursday of this summit seeming to be canceled was astounding. And then people kind of headed out to try to start their holiday weekend on Friday, and it looked like we were back on, and here we are on Tuesday. I would say, you know, it feels to me like it's more likely than not to happen. You know, the question is, where are we headed? This has always been the question, and we still don't have much more clarity. What kind of a summit would this be, whether or not it happens on June 12th or June 20th or later in the summer? What kind of deal is possible between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un? And so just as we are kind of confused about the process of just scheduling the thing, I think we have to ask ourselves whether that is foreshadowing the, you know, total lack of clarity about what kind of agreement would actually be struck, whether Trump and Kim are talking about the same thing, the practicalities of denuclearization. There was an expert report, I believe, conducted by some folks out at Stanford, including a nuclear expert who's visited North Korea dozens of times. He said it would take 15 years to dismantle North Korea's nuclear complex. So that's the longer answer. The short answer is it does feel to me like both Trump and Kim really do want a meeting. And I would wager that we are going to see one within the next few weeks, whether or not it's exactly on the 12th. There's not much time left to plan for it. But the bigger questions remain substantively, how is this going to work?
Let me play this clip from Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. This was on Sunday, telling ABC's This Week. Host Martha Raddatz asked him about the summit. He said that he doesn't think Kim Jong-un could ever give up his country's nuclear weapons.
I remain convinced that he does not want to denuclearize. In fact, he will not denuclearize, but he wants to give off this perception that he's this open leader, that he's peaceful, that he's reasonable. And that's why you see they basically stop talking to us for 2 weeks. The president makes his decision, and all of a sudden he shows up and has this meeting with the president of South Korea. And now they're talking peace again. And now all of a sudden everything's moving.
Senator, he did blow up, it appeared, parts of his nuclear facility.
It's a show.
He released three Americans.
It's all a show.
Byron York, it's all a show. Have we seen this movie before?
Well, the thing that strikes me about the scheduling part of it right now, and it does appear to me to be back on, is that we have 2 weeks left. I mean, it can go off the rails again and back onto the rails. If anybody thought at the beginning of this that there was going to be kind of a smooth process that led us to Singapore on June 12th, they were just wrong. And I think we have seen this kind of jockeying position for position. I think what Senator Rubio said is there's a lot to be said for it in terms of how much you can trust the North Koreans, which is not at all. But, you know, it became clear that the president seemed to want it too much, you know, kind of smiling when people talked about the Nobel Peace Prize and that kind of stuff. And then the North Koreans became very belligerent and aggressive and provocative. And then Trump called their bluff. And then it became clear that they needed it and wanted it too. So I do think it's going to happen. But there's a connection between what Michael was talking about, which is the substance of this, and the scheduling mm-hmm. of this, because you do kind of want to know what you're going to do before you have the meeting. And clearly, they haven't gotten to that point yet.
Let me get Mike in here quickly from Somerville, Massachusetts on this point. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, two quick points.
Yep.
The meeting with Kim Jong-un will be a disaster. Trump has no foreign policy experience, no governing experience. He can't focus. He can't concentrate. I believe he's just doing this as a PR stunt to take away from the Russian investigation, and Kim Jong-un will play him like a fiddle. Second point is, why is the mainstream media so surprised as to what Trump says and does toward Russia and Mueller? They seem completely surprised. What about the possibility that they seem to be afraid to talk about is that Trump is actually guilty of conspiring and colluding with Russia?
We'll get to that after the break, Mike. I want to stick with North Korea for the next 40 seconds. Michael Crowley, you talked about Byron talked about substance and scheduling. I mean, these diplomatic negotiations usually take months, if not years, before a meeting like this. We're down to a matter of days at this point, Michael.
They do, which raises the question of whether what Trump really wants here, and possibly also Kim, is a wonderful photo op, a handshake, the beginning of a process that has lots of lofty rhetoric. You know, for Kim, he wants to be taken seriously as an important world leader who can get FaceTime with an American president. It's something he and his father and grandfather wanted for years and didn't get. And for Trump, he wants to be seen as a statesman who can conduct foreign policy on the world stage. But there are real questions about whether anything substantive can be hammered out in advance to make this more than really a photo op.
We are discussing the week ahead in Washington and around the world this hour. A terrific panel. Michael Crowley from Politico, Shauna Thomas from Vice News, Byron York from The Washington Examiner. And listeners, you can join the conversation. Are gas prices wiping out your gains from the GOP tax cuts? What's your message for your lawmaker? I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking at the week ahead with a panel of top reporters this hour, and you can join the conversation. Who has the momentum heading into the midterms? Are you ready to send back your lawmakers to Washington for another term? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great panel today. Byron York of The Washington Examiner, Shauna Thomas of Vice News, and Michael Crowley of Politico. Well, we started this hour talking about President Trump's Memorial Day tweet. A lot of listener response to that. Another tweet just crossed the line. The fake mainstream media has, from the time I announced I was running for president, run the most highly sophisticated and dishonest disinformation campaign in the history of politics. No matter how well we do, they find fault. But the forgotten men and women won. I am president. To this point, Andrea has a call from Bristol, Connecticut. Hi, Andrea. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I disagree with one of your commentators who said that we need to calm down about President Trump's tweets. I think that his tweets are an indication that we really can't disregard the path that he's leading us down. He is attacking his own Justice Department, the intelligence community, the Mueller investigation. I don't think that serious people who look at this can actually say, for example, there's any real bias in the Mueller investigation that's been demonstrated at all. And I think he's helping to erode our democracy, and the tweets are just an example of that.
Andrea, thank you very much. Shauna Thomas, I believe that was you who made that comment. I mean, this clearly is not a president who communicates like other presidents. But there's Andrea saying, you know, we can't disregard the substance here, that he's eroding our democracy. What do you say in response?
Well, I don't totally disagree that we can't ignore the substance, but I think specifically about that Memorial Day tweet, that's one of those things that felt designed to elicit a response. I think in terms of when he also tweets about, you know, whether there's corruption within the FBI, which can in turn like start to erode our democracy a little bit when he talks about the Mueller investigation as a witch hunt, whereas you have people in Congress, Republicans and Democrats, saying that it's not a witch hunt and also let's let Mueller do what Mueller is going to do. I think that's different. But I do think sometimes there are these tweets where he throws something in or someone on his staff throws something in that is designed to get a rise out of people. And maybe we should just spend the time focusing on some of the more important things that your caller did bring up.
Andrea, thank you very much for bringing that up. Let me turn to Congress. In recess, as of today, members are back in their districts. Byron York, jump back in here. What are you seeing? Are these Congress members getting an earful back home? What are the issues they're hearing about in their districts looking ahead?
Well, I think you have a couple of things. One, Trump does dominate our political conversation to an extent that no president has, in my experience, even though presidents usually do dominate the political conversation, he has done it even more. And I think what's interesting here is among Democrats who you know by history and polls seem to be headed to a victory to win control of the House of Representatives, are having to figure out how to deal with Trump. We've seen such things as a poll from, I think it was Quinnipiac, that showed 71% of Democrats would like to see Democrats impeach the president if they win control of the House. Back in the George W. Bush years, that was maybe in the 30s or 40s, the number of Democrats who wanted to see Bush impeached. So they're having to deal with on the one hand with their bases just opposition to just everything Trump does, and their belief that in a larger sense they have to deal with the president, and running on impeachment is not a platform for reelection.
Mm-hmm. And yet, Shauna Thomas, President Trump, while he's in Nashville today, stumping to raise money, rally support for a really critical Senate seat, Bob Corker's seat. Is it fair to say Republicans are more comfortable, it seems, touting President Trump's leadership than Democrats are arguing against it?
I think so. I mean, I think you look at the district that you're in or you look at the state you're in, you take a look at how much President Trump won by or how much Hillary Clinton lost by, and you make sort of a cost-benefit analysis. But right now, his supporters are, whether his polling numbers are between 30 and 40%, those are people who love President Trump and are somewhat, inclined to go out and vote if he can rally them. And because of that, you don't want to turn off the people who might show up and vote in your primary or definitely show up and vote in your general. So hugging President Trump a little closer is, in a lot of ways, politically, makes sense. And also, one of the things that we've seen over the course of the last couple of years with all of the sort of special elections is that you also don't necessarily want President Trump saying something bad about you, especially if you're a Republican, because that also turns people off. I do think it's interesting that Democrats are also trying to figure out exactly how to message about President Trump right now in this election. You know, there's a group called Navigator Research, which is run by a bunch of former Democratic staffers at all levels. And, a press release popped in my inbox that said that they are trying to, like, hand progressives the right message to counteract President Trump. And one of the things that they found out was that a lot of Americans want the investigation to continue, according to their polls, the Mueller investigation. But progressives need to focus on indictments and crimes instead of rehashing 2016, that looking back turns people off as well. I think it's very interesting that there are outside groups trying to spend money to figure out how do we make this Trump message work. But we know, I mean, the idea of impeachment as a message, even Nancy Pelosi has said that is not a message that I think is going to work, because that is a message that will not get us anywhere. Politically, impeachment is not possible. So why don't we focus on things that we can actually, talk about?
Byron York, it's worth noting, I think, that President Trump today suggested there might be meddling in the midterm elections with a tweet that said, quote, the 13 angry Democrats plus people who worked 8 years for Obama working on a rigged Russia witch hunt will be meddling with the midterm elections, especially now that Republicans, stay tough, are taking the lead in the polls, end quote. Byron York, do you see President Trump doing anything differently? Is this a new strategy? I mean, is he going to change course from what he did in the special elections or the 2018 primaries?
Well, the 13 angry Democrats are in his terms, the Robert Mueller prosecution team.
Right.
So that's what he's talking about there. And I think what we're going to see here is just another test of the laws of political gravity. I mean, you always wondered, you know, when Trump was ahead all through the Republican primaries and then behind in the general election and then he wins, so many of the assumptions that people who follow politics made didn't work for that election. Now we have a midterm election. Trump is not on the ballot. But what effect will he have on it? And I was just looking in the Real Clear Politics average of polls, Trump's job approval rating is 44%, which is not good, but it's good for him. He has never been higher than 46%. A couple of weeks after he was inaugurated, he was at 46. Now he's at 44. He'd been down as low as about 37, I think. And so the question is there some sort of Trump effect that we didn't see in 2016 that will be in operation in 2018 in an entirely different context when Trump is not on the ballot, but every member of the House of Representatives is.
As we move toward the midterms here, President Trump doubling down on what he calls, quote, Spygate. Here's President Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani telling CNN's State of the Union on Sunday that the attempt to discredit the Mueller investigation and the latest Spygate controversy are part of a public relations campaign to sway voter opinion and keep impeachment at bay.
We're defending here. It is for public opinion because eventually the decision here is going to be impeach, not impeach. Members of Congress, Democrat and Republican, are going to be informed a lot by their constituents. So our jury is as it should be, is the American people. And the American people, yes, are Republicans, largely, okay. Independents, pretty substantially, and even some Democrats now question the legitimacy of it.
Michael Crowley, Rudy Giuliani saying that Spygate's essentially a PR tactic to sway voter opinion.
Yeah, the Rudy show. Rudy is like the spinoff show, like Better Call Saul, is the spinoff from Breaking Bad. And you could have this whole reality show that is just Rudy Giuliani and his kind of zaniness, because he's talking a lot. He's saying things that are sometimes wrong factually, and he's saying things that I think a lot of PR and legal experts might say were better left kept in his head. And that's an example where, you know, I don't think he needs to be talking about the president's strategy quite that explicitly. And, you know, in particular, suggesting or stating outright that attacks on the Justice Department are really a PR gambit and not an expression of genuine substantive moral outrage. But it's clear at the same time, he's just stating the obvious. This is where Trump's defense is headed. You know, Trump doesn't have a particularly clear legal strategy. It does seem to be a PR strategy that is designed to defeat the Russia investigation in the court of public opinion and hold off a potential impeachment. The Trump team believes and claims that Robert Mueller's team has said, although Mueller has not confirmed this, that Mueller is unable to indict Trump, that there's Justice Department legal guidance that says that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And Rudy says that Mueller's team has communicated this to the Trump team in some fashion. I think that's likely true. I don't know about the specific communication, but my sense is that the consensus among legal experts is that Mueller could not indict Trump. So indeed, this would seem to be headed for an impeachment if there is going to be any sort of action taken against Trump for any crimes or alleged crimes. And so that's the dynamic.
Shauna Thomas, one of our listeners, is asking here or saying, isn't Rudy Giuliani openly admitting obstruction with these comments?
I'm not so sure Rudy Giuliani is openly admitting obstruction, but I do think he is, much like what Michael said, you know, the Spygate, that term that we're now using, is a branding strategy. It is a branding strategy that is now in headlines. It is a branding strategy that is now on this radio show. And therefore, it helps bolster just it being out there helps bolster this point that President Trump and Rudy Giuliani want to make, that this Mueller investigation isn't a real thing. The thing that we can do, especially as journalists, is say, you know what, it is a real thing. Mueller is investigating this. It will keep going on. And people are going to take their opinions from whatever news source they're going to take them from, or from President Trump himself. But I'm not so sure that means that what the president is trying to do specifically here is obstruct justice. I think what he's trying to do is sway public opinion.
Can I add one thing
in
here? Well, impeachment is a political process. It's going to be decided by members of the House of Representatives, and if it gets to it, in the Senate. And that's all Giuliani is saying. And if you didn't live through 1998, look it up. This is what Bill Clinton did. The White House continually attacked in that year of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, the independent counsel, Kenneth Starr. They called it a witch hunt. They called for an investigation of the investigators. Trump is taking a page from this playbook of attacking the prosecutor.
Here's a clip from ABC's This Week on Sunday, where California Congressman Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, dismissed claims made by President Trump that the FBI used an informant to undermine his presidential campaign.
There is no evidence to support that spy theory. This is just a piece of propaganda the president wants to put out and repeat. And certainly we've seen this pattern before.
Let's go to Aaron in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Aaron. Hi, Aaron. Are you there? All right, Michael Crowley, tell us what to look forward to in the Russia investigation this week.
Well, I think we're going to see Trump and his allies continue to press this Spygate theme. I also was struck by the president's tweet this morning suggesting that the Russia investigation amounts to meddling in the midterm elections. And I think we are increasingly
That's the tweet
hearing.
I read earlier, yeah.
Yes, that's right. And I think that that's a theme that we're going to be increasingly hearing, which is the idea that the investigation itself is a kind of improper interference in the elections. And, oh, now the Democrats are meddling. And, you know, there's meddling going on all over the place. And everything's crazy. And who knows what's real? I mean, that's kind of the Trump strategy, is to throw up a ton of smoke and accuse other people of doing the thing that he's accused of doing. So I think we'll be hearing more of that theme. I think Byron makes an interesting point. The Clintons really did go after Kenneth Starr very hard, and we could have a long and interesting conversation about that. I just want to say one thing that I think gets lost in this conversation sometimes is a reminder that, you know, whatever you think about Mueller, it's important to remember that fundamentally what happened here is that a hostile foreign government interfered in our election. Whether or not Donald Trump colluded, whether or not Donald Trump obstructed justice, I do fear that the debate around this is obscuring that fundamental fact. And we were talking about the midterms a few minutes ago. A lot of senior, current and former U.S. officials believe that the Russians are going to be at it again in these upcoming elections. And it is pretty distressing that there's not more of an emphasis on that reality.
Whether the Russians are at it again, Shauna Thomas, I hear a lot of Trump supporters out there saying, you know, the special counsel is pushing. They're looking farther and farther afield to uncover collusion that does not exist. You know, what do you see moving forward as far as this Russia investigation?
I mean, I do think Robert Mueller and his team is pushing, and that is one of and this is something that multiple people have said, that is one of the dangers for President Trump in the opening of this special investigation, is that once you start to get at what did Russia do, did the Trump team collude with Russia, which we do not know the answer to, but we do know based on what the intelligence community has said that the Russians did somehow infiltrate our elections, that as you dive deeper and deeper into that, you are going to get into who does President Trump know, which led us to the Michael Cohen situation. And Michael Cohen hasn't been indicted by anyone yet, but there is an entirely different court looking into that. There's an entirely different team of people looking into that, which then brings us to Trump's businesses. And, you know, there's been a lot of documentation that, you know, as someone who works in real estate in New York, that there could be a lot of shady ties there. And I think because of that, the Trump people will be able to say, okay, this has gone too far afield, and use that as another PR tactic, much like Spygate. But the other thing is, if there is something illegal to uncover, that Mueller, I think, feels a duty to keep trying to uncover things. Doesn't mean he will. I am not saying I have any idea where Mueller is taking this thing. I don't even propose to know that. And he's been very good at keeping his head down. But one of the interesting things is he doesn't fight back on this because he doesn't have to. He's doing his job and he'll keep doing it.
Listener Deb says Mueller should finish his work and move on. There's nothing there to impeach this president. Mueller doing more investigations would only bolster Trump's base and his presidential position. We are discussing what's to come this week in Washington and beyond, and you can join the conversation, listeners. Where are those missing migrant children? We'll get to that after the break. Are you watching the firefight between Israel and Gaza? Michael Crowley, Shauna Thomas, Byron York, stick with us. I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. We'll be right back.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Didn't you just make that up?
Well, yeah. I just...
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're looking ahead to the week in Washington and around the world this hour, and you can join the conversation. What are you watching for this week out of Washington and elsewhere? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm speaking this hour with Shauna Thomas of Vice News, Michael Crowley of Politico, and Byron York of The Washington Examiner. I want to get to gas prices across the country this hour, 31% higher than they were this time last year. Here's NBC's Dan Shaneman on Friday with a look at U.S. gas prices heading into the Memorial Day weekend.
AAA reports the average price for a gallon of regular unleaded fuel is approaching $3, 59 cents higher than a year ago. Experts say consumers have more money to spend and more confidence thanks to a strong economy.
Shauna Thomas, a lot of Americans with a big tax cut paycheck in their pocket, now looking at all of that maybe evaporating a bit as they're spending more on gasoline. Talk to us about this story from a political perspective.
I mean, I think this story is a really good example of when you are running a country, as President Trump is, that doing one thing can affect another thing. So Republicans want to run on these tax cuts, but because of the Iran deal situation, because of other pressures within the world, you're seeing a rise in gas prices. And we always see a rise in gas prices in the summer due to other oil industry issues. But you have to remember that everything, especially when it comes to foreign affairs and money and the economy, is like this seesaw of things. And so one thing can go up and look great and, you know, you have a little bit more money in your paycheck. Hopefully you might not realize it yet, but there could be a little more money there. But you're going to end up spending it on gas prices. And the thing is, it's that feeling of going up to the pump, pumping and realizing, oh, I just spent more than I did the last time 2 weeks ago when I filled up my tank. Mm-hmm. That is a more immediate feeling that keeps on giving. And it is much harder in some ways to see a small amount of money in your paycheck. And so one of the things, and if we're going to go back to the conversation about PR, is that Republicans have to figure out how do we advertise around that? How do we say to people, hey, by the way, you're able to afford that gas because you have a little bit more money in your paycheck? It's a hard sort of political PR conversation to have, but it's one that is at the forefront of the conversation because we are in a midterm election year and people know this is what people vote on. They vote on how much money is in their paycheck. They vote on whether they have enough money to take that trip to fill up their tank of gas and go to the beach. Taxes is something that's really, really hard to message other than saying, I want to lower them. Okay, you lowered them. Does anyone feel it? We'd have to go out and ask 100 people on the street about that. But people do feel when they have to fill up their tank and it costs more.
Let's ask Reggie about that from Oskaloosa, Iowa. Hi, Reggie. You're on the line.
Hi. Yes, I have noticed the increase in my paycheck from the tax cut. And I work for a company that delivers fuel. And so I see the prices going up all the time. The increase has taken probably a third of my tax cut, maybe. Even if, you know, if we didn't have the tax cut, that would still be money I was spending and didn't have the money that the government wasn't taking from me in the first place to help offset that. So, you know, I don't, it amazes me how every time, you know, what prices go up, it goes, well, tax cut. One had nothing to do with the other, but everybody wants to take everybody, you know, the working people's money. When it's not the government's money, it's ours.
In the first place. Reggie, thank you. Michael Crowley, what's at the heart of the gas price spike? I mean, to Reggie's point, I mean, what's really going on here? Is there something overseas? Is it standoff with Iran, tightening supply? What is it?
So some of it is seasonal. Gas prices always rise as the summer driving season, I guess it's called, begins. But there are some global factors, as there almost always are. One of them is Trump's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal and impose sanctions, at this point threatening to impose sanctions on other countries that do business with Iran. And substantially, that's going to involve oil trading, and that is likely to take a significant amount of Iranian oil off the market. And by some estimates, that has added several dollars to the price of oil, which I think is now in the high 60s. So if it's added, you know, $5 to $7, you may be adding about 10% to the price of a barrel of oil. Venezuela is a major oil producer, and it's because the country is in a state of political and economic chaos. Its oil production has been dropping for some time now, but I gathered it's really gone off a cliff more recently, and global demand remains strong because the global economy is healthy. So all these factors together are pushing up the price of oil. You know, this is interesting because actually it's good news in many ways for oil producers like Saudi Arabia and Russia up to a point. And one potentially positive development for Trump is that the Saudis and the Russians now are nervous that the price of oil is rising so high. There could be a kind of long-term backlash effect where it prompts more alternative energy development, shale drilling, use of electric cars. And there's some talk about, you know, actions by the Saudis, the Russians, OPEC to try to push the price of oil back down. And so the geopolitics of this are very complicated. One last quick thought, and I'll stop talking, which is that this is one of the few opportunities, and I think Shauna touched on this, Democrats have to hit Trump on the economy, and they really are seizing on this gas price issue. But, you know, generally speaking, the economy is in pretty good shape, and Trump is riding high off it, and I think that helps to explain why his poll numbers aren't lower than they are. This is sort of the one good entree Democrats have, where you have a pocketbook issue. It's easy for people to relate to, and it even has the fringe benefit of allowing Democrats to tie in what they think is Trump's reckless foreign policy with a pocketbook issue like the price of gas at the pump, and to say that this Iran nuclear deal decision was dumb and it's creating new risks. And on top of everything else, it means that you're paying more to fill up your car. So silver lining for Democrats there.
Reggie, thanks so much for the call. So let me take us from gas prices to these reports that the federal government has lost track of nearly 1,500 immigrant children in their custody. Shauna Thomas, we'll look at this in depth tomorrow on this program, but give us a sense now of what's happening here.
So Health and Human Services said that they put out a statement saying that the kids aren't lost. It's just that they go back and they try to do a follow-up with the families where they put these unaccompanied children, and that in a certain amount of the cases, they did not get any response back. Now, whether that as an excuse is going to fly, this is unclear. It is, I'm sure that HHS is probably going to try to follow up to clear this up. I think one of the things that people have to understand is not to conflate the new Border Patrol policy of possibly separating children from their families when they try to cross the border with this particular thing. This came out as a review of something that happened in the Obama administration. These numbers are from 2016. So I think that's one thing, but it's difficult not to conflate these two things and take the conversation to a place where we talk about this somewhat new policy of trying to basically scare people into not coming over the border because their kids may be taken away from them.
Speaking on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday, North Carolina Republican Congressman Mark Meadows agreed with a tweet that President Trump sent out that essentially said that separating migrant families at the border is, quote, horrible.
I can't imagine that it's the law that you have to separate these individuals. Now, obviously, human trafficking is a big deal. You know, how do you know that they're really the parents in a family unit? So we would have to address that. But I think conservatives and moderates, Democrats and Republicans all agree that keeping a family together is the best strategy. And it's something we need to address and will address.
Byron York, talk about the difference between a law. Is this a law or is this simply a policy issued by this presidency, by the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, in an effort to scare people into not coming to the border?
Well, Sessions did say, I believe, in his remarks, as required by law. It depends on the legal status of the adult here. But on the 1,500 people that Shauna was correctly talking about, they arrived alone. These are unaccompanied minors who came alone. They were not separated from anybody. And as a follow-up, I think the Health Department of Health and Human Services studied, it was more than 6,000 of them, tried to find where are they now. And they were able to find most of them. And these were people who had found sponsors. The government found sponsors for these unaccompanied minors to live in the United States. And they were not able to find all of them because some of them had run away. Some mm-hmm. of them had left. They had moved and not left an address. Let me read you something from a New York Times article actually today about this.
Okay.
Losing track of children who arrive at the border alone is not a new phenomenon. An Inspector General report in 2016 showed that the federal government was able to reach only 84% of the children it had placed, leaving 4,159 unaccounted for. It is a bad situation when a minor arrives at the border alone. The government has a responsibility to do something with that person, and they have been able to find sponsors to allow them to live in the United States. It is not a surprise that you could pick 6,000 out and you couldn't find every single one of them years later.
And I think the question, though, of separating kids from their families when they get to the border, which, once again, is a different situation than this study, is one of, is HHS and is the Office of Refugee Resettlement within HHS capable of taking care of more kids if you decide to separate them from their parents? So if
it's
you
not really their
them,
mandate, right?
I mean, it is and it isn't in terms of when unaccompanied minors come over the border. It is HHS and the Office of Refugee Resettlement who does take those kids. So there is this there is a mechanism for that.
Okay.
But they right now they don't have enough beds to take in the people who are adults who are crossing the border. And it is unclear if HHS has the resources to, like, actively separate kids from parents and then actually take care of these kids in a good way.
And one last thing, which is the government does, in the courses of law enforcement, separate children and parents all the time when they send parents to jail. And in terms of recidivist border crossers, people who've been deported before, people who the United States would take some sort of legal action against as opposed to a first-timer, this is something that does take place, and it's the government's responsibility, which they do, to try to place the child somewhere with a relative or with someone who will sponsor them.
In an April 24th PBS Frontline special about human trafficking, Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman argued that the immigrant children in federal custody deserve to be treated properly, regardless of their legal status.
We've got these kids. They're here. They're living on our soil, and for us to just, you know, assume someone else is going to take care of them and throw them to the wolves, which is what HHS was doing, is flat out wrong. I don't care what you think about immigration policy. It's wrong.
Let's get Randall in here on this point from Montgomery, Alabama. Hi, Randall. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, I think we ought to look at the structure on how to take care of these kids because their future is, you know, it's in doubt. And if we had a chance to help children, you know, have a better life, this is something we should look at closely and look at broadening the structure. But also, mm-hmm. in the United States, if I were to abandon my child, I would be thrown in jail. So I don't think we ought to permit the parents to come because they abandon the children.
Randall, we will get more into this tomorrow. I do appreciate your call. So stay tuned for that, listeners. Let me wrap up because we just have a couple of minutes left. Michael Crowley, got to get to Gaza. Israeli jets bombed Gaza just today, hours after militants from the territory fired into communities in southern Israel. Put the latest action into perspective for us here. What do you see?
Well, you know, Gaza is one of these problems from hell that persists and no one is able to find a good solution for it. You know, Gaza is a tortured and cursed place, and it's really hard to see, you know, how this ends in any kind of a peaceful, happy way in the near future. Donald Trump campaign saying that Middle East peace might be an easier thing to achieve than people realized, and maybe it needed a, you know, fresh pair of eyes and a deal maker's savvy, put his son-in-law in charge of the Middle East peace process. There had been talk, I would say sort of in the late winter, that the White House was getting ready to present a peace plan. And we haven't seen any sign of one. We haven't seen any real plausible evidence that any kind of peace talks will be launching again. Trump, of course, moved the U.S. embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which helped to precipitate a huge inflammation of violence on the Israeli-Gaza border. And now we see, you know, continued violence in Gaza. That situation is getting worse, not better. I don't think that the embassy move is the only or even the primary reason for it. But I guess, you know, the summary thought here is that things seem to be getting worse, not better, between Israel and the Palestinians. And I think the prospects for this sort of peace deal that Donald Trump was talking about are looking quite dim.
Let me end with Starbucks, because today 8,000 Starbucks stores across the country will close their doors. They're going to train 175,000 employees about racial bias. Shauna Thomas, this was, of course, after that incident at a Starbucks in Philadelphia. What do you see here in 30 seconds? An effort to overhaul the company's image, PR effort? Will this work? What do you see?
30 seconds to talk about implicit bias.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it is not a bad thing that Starbucks is closing their doors and at least having this conversation about implicit bias. It would probably do a lot of people good to actually stop, think, and think about why they have the opinions they have. And at the very least, some of the people doing this may have that moment where they think about why they want to call the cops on someone or why they don't want that person in their store. So that's a good thing. But also, it's a PR move. And it's a big one, and they're getting headlines out of it, and people will say, hey, look at Starbucks, they're doing a good thing, whether that actually changes anything or not.
Well, a great look at the week ahead, and I do appreciate this panel. Shauna Thomas, Washington Bureau Chief for Vice News. Shauna, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Byron York, Chief Political Correspondent for the Washington Examiner and a Fox News contributor. Byron, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michael Crowley, National Security Editor and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Politico. Always great to have you, Michael. Thanks.
Always great to be here. Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, did the U.S. really lose those migrant children? We'll get into that more, dig into it. Until then, I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.